of life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Israeli forces once again attacked Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, leaving dozens of worshippers injured. Afghan officials announced the arrest of the mastermind of Thursday's deadly Daesh-claimed attack on a Shia mosque in the northern city. And the mayor of Ukraine's Mariupol calls for the full evacuation of the city a day after Russia claims control over the strategic port. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Tensions simmering in occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli forces have once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. So far, at least 43 Palestinians are confirmed injured. Israeli forces made arrests too. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to the latest attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement said that it is closely monitoring the situation there and is fully ready to respond to Israeli crimes against Palestinian people. Hamas also called on the international community to restrain the occupying Israeli regime and stop its aggression against Al-Aqsa. Tensions at the holy site began last Friday when Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers, injuring scores of them. The aggression is taking place during the fasting month of Ramadan. We reach out to our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandel, to tell us more about the latest Israeli attack on Al-Aqsa.
Well, first of all, we can say that it's a clear Israeli intentions are to keep Palestinians away from the Al-Aqsa Mosque and to prevent Muslim Palestinians of freedom of worship inside Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. What happened this morning is that Palestinian worshippers entered the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex in order to perform the morning prayers. Hundreds of them preferred to remain in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and not to leave it. They were chanting when Israeli forces raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. They were chanting, Allahu Akbar, Allah is great. And they wanted to remain there because it's a Friday. And they want to remain there in order to perform the Friday prayers. They were thinking that in case they left the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex, the Israeli soldiers might not allow them to return back to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. That's why Israeli police raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, attacked the people. They fired tear gas, rubber-coated bullets towards the worshippers, and tried to force them out. As you have mentioned, a number of Palestinians have been wounded.
In the run-up to International Quds Day, a UK-based rights group is calling on supporters of the Palestinian struggle to lift their voices in support and solidarity. The 2022 edition of the Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is an opportunity to remind Palestinians living under occupation and the diaspora that they are not alone. Amina Taylor has more.
Violence, oppression, and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important. With the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think what I have seen, ordinary people responding so fantastically.
In the lead up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing.
Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag.
As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition, a fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, you know, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute. And, you know, they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
The Taliban in Afghanistan say they have arrested a Daesh member in connection with the Thursday attack on a Shia mosque in the north. The Taliban say the terrorist was mastermind of the blast in Mazar-e-Sharif, where a dozen people were killed and many more injured. The Daesh terror group had claimed the attack on the mosque. It also took responsibility for another explosion that hit the northern city of Kunduz on Thursday. At least four people lost their lives in the blast. Explosions were the latest in a series of deadly attacks targeting Afghan cities since the Taliban takeover last month. The cost of living crisis is worsening in the UK, where retail sales are sliding fast while consumer confidence nears all-time lows. Retail sales dropped by 1.4% in March from February. That is according to the Office for National Statistics. Market research firm GfK also says consumer confidence has fallen in April and is close to its lowest levels in nearly 50 years. In the meantime, inflation is at 7%, the highest in 30 years. It is likely to increase further beyond the 2% target of the central bank. British households have already cut spending to cope with higher costs of food and fuel, and that is expected to worsen in the coming months, with energy companies warning of what they call a truly horrific bills crisis in autumn. The bills already saw a sharp jump this month in the wake of the Ukraine war. Our correspondent Amina Taylor in London gave us more details about the cost of living crisis in the UK and how people are coping with it.
The energy price rise that you mentioned there, which for some consumers was more than 50%, so that will be ensuring that consumer confidence is low. Something else that hasn't been mentioned is that we've been cutting back on buying not just things online that would be non-essentials, but food bills since November. Well, those have been shrinking as people think about ways in which they can kind of manage the pennies. Now, we throw around figures sometimes like 7% inflation rate, the Bank of England putting up the base rate to 0.75% and so on. But let's just drill down a little bit about what that actually means for people like myself who earn more than the average wage here. So I can't even tell you about how those less fortunate are going to be, because the picture is so startling. It's such a negative outlook.
A top Russian general says his country will try to take full control over eastern and southern Ukraine as part of the second phase of its special operation there. Major General Rustam Minakev says that taking Donbass and southern Ukraine will provide a land corridor to the Crimean Peninsula. His comments come a day after Russia took control of the port city of Mariupol in the south. President Vladimir Putin said the city is now liberated, but his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky promised that Mariupol will continue to resist.
The war in Ukraine could be entering a new stage, as Russia says it has achieved its biggest victory since it launched its offensive nearly 2 months ago. Russian President Vladimir Putin announced on Thursday that Russian forces have won the battle for the strategic southern city of Mariupol. Russian forces appear to be in control of the city, including its important but now seriously damaged port. At a joint appearance with his defense minister Sergei Shoigu, Putin declared that, quote, the completion of combat work to liberate Mariupol is a success. The Russian president offered congratulations to Shoigu and Russian forces. But what is the strategic significance of the latest developments of the war? Mariupol is a major port in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. It is situated between areas held by pro-Russian forces in Ukraine and Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula that came under Russian control in 2014. Taking the city now will allow Russia to connect the two areas as it steps up its military campaign in Ukraine's east. Moscow can now secure more of the southern coastline, complete a land bridge between Russian soil and the Crimean Peninsula, and free up more troops to join the battle for Donbass, which is Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland. Despite Russia's announcement of victory in Mariupol, hundreds of Ukrainian troops and civilians are still holding out inside a giant steel factory in the city. Russian forces have tried for weeks to dislodge them, but to no avail.
The Russian president says his troops do not need to enter the sprawling steelworks in Mariupol for now. The Kremlin has ordered Russian troops to block off the industrial area. Ukraine says Putin wants to avoid a final clash in the industrial complex because he lacks enough troops to defeat them.
The Kremlin says there is no need for Russian troops to enter the complex passageways of the sprawling Azovstal steelworks. The Russian president ordered his forces to block off the industrial area so that, quote, not even a fly can get through. Ukraine and its Western allies have disputed Russia's claim of complete victory in the city. But Moscow seems to be already looking beyond the southern city. Russian officials say the war's main objective is now capturing the mostly Russian-speaking Donbass region.
As I speak, the Russian army controls an area in Ukraine which is larger than England and Wales combined, from Kharkov to Donetsk to Lugansk to Zaporizhia to Kherson. And as a result of the ongoing battle at present in the Donbass, it looks like that the Russian army will increase even further the land it controls in eastern Ukraine and also in southern Ukraine.
Last month, Russian forces were driven away from the capital Kiev and northern Ukraine. Things will definitely not be smooth in the east either, as Western nations rush to funnel heavy arms into Ukraine to help it counter the offensive.
The Ukrainian armed forces were trained by NATO, equipped by NATO, and trained to the standards of NATO. So that is a major factor as to why the Ukrainian armed forces have put up stiff resistance to the Russian army.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced another $800 million to help Ukrainian forces fight in the east. He said this week that Washington and its allies are moving as fast as possible to provide Kiev with the weapons that it needs. According to Biden, the U.S. and its allies are facing a critical window of time where they are going to set the stage for the next phase of this war. Much is at stake in Ukraine for major world powers. The war has been widely described as an escalation of the never-ending tug of war between the West and the Russian Federation. The outcome of the conflict could have far-reaching consequences and may shift the balance of power in the region and beyond.
After 3 weeks of waiting for a responding to Sana'a International Airport, the Yemeni Civil Aviation Authority has announced the start of commercial flights to Sana'a next Sunday. According to the announcement, there will be one flight a week, which of course is not enough to help the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. Abdulatif Al-Washali has more.
Yemen Civil Aviation and Meteorology Authority announced that the first commercial flight to Sana'a International Airport will start next Sunday from Antu, Jordan. Observers say the UN brokered agreement said there will be two flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan, and allowing one flight only is not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Announcing the start of one flight per week to Jordan is not enough and confirms there are no sincere intentions by the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the declared UN truce. There must be a full opening of Sana'a Airport and the port of Hodeidah because the humanitarian situation cannot tolerate more restrictions.
The Ministry of Health says thousands of patients, including children, are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Therefore, the United Nations should fulfill its duty and remove any restrictions on the two weekly flights.
Yemeni patients suffer greatly due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport because they need to travel abroad for treatment. There are 30,000 registered patients in the higher medical committee, including children suffering from congenital anomalies and cancer. We demand the United Nations and the UN envoy open Sana'a's airport permanently and not for one or two flights per week, as it's not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 and imposed a closure on Sana'a International Airport. This closure has led to the death of thousands of patients, including children, especially amid the collapse of the healthcare system in the country due to the years-long Saudi war and the blockade.
Yemenis received the news of resuming the flights of Sana'a International Airport with hopes to see further flights to other destinations around the world. They say opening Sana'a Airport will save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, who are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
It's a double celebration in Iran, only days apart for the army and Sepah. So let's have a word on those forces today. The classical approach to realistic international relations defines power in terms of military capabilities. Traditionally, this concept places a high value on states' reliance primarily on military force for maintaining their independence. Iran, like any other player in the chaotic international system, strives to maximize its military power in order to preserve its survival. For this purpose, and to offset the problems imposed by the arms embargo since 1979, the country has embarked on different methods, including developing asymmetrical defense capability and relying on its allies to preserve its status as a major military player in West Asia. The Iranian military consists of two major institutions, regular forces or the army, called Artesh, and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, called Sepah. These two operate separately but are coordinated. The Artesh is based on classical doctrine and operates as a traditional military organization, while Sepah is based on revolutionary doctrine and operates by asymmetric warfare. Now, with an imposing extra-regional military presence in the Persian Gulf and West Asia, Sepah or IRGC has gained increasing power in Iran over past decades. For a closer look, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Army Day is celebrated annually on April the 18th. It was established by the father and first leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979. 2 months after the fall of the deposed Shah or King, he met with Iranian Armed Forces soldiers who made an invaluable contribution to the victory of the revolution. A few days later, Ayatollah Khomeini named April the 18th as Army Day, calling for military parades to exhibit the nation's military preparedness. After the victory of the revolution, the army got scattered, according to one of our wartime gems. But then come the 1980 eight-year imposed war with Iraq, the country's safety and sovereignty was not abandoned. Brigadier General Ovesi may be retired from his service and flying fighter planes in war, but he's still today departing his knowledge as university professor.
The Americans left the country expecting that we would not be able to fly the F-5s, but we managed to fly them. Then the war started. We managed to confront the enemy's attacks by those F-5s. Moreover, let me tell you about the F-14 aircrafts. It's interesting to note that the F-14s had computer systems installed back in the 1960s when no one even knew what computers were. It was considered to be very high-tech at the time. Much to our enemy's consternation, we flew the aircraft and defended the nation.
Iran's Revolution Guard Corps, also known as the Sepah, was also established in April 1979 by Ayatollah Khomeini as a paramilitary organization charged with protecting the newborn Islamic Republic. In time of war or facing foreign threats, however, the two military arms join hands. Mr. Haji Najjar, a Sepah Sardar or general, tells how that worked during the Iraq-Iran war.
Following Saddam's attack on Iran in September 1980, the morning after the Iraqi warplanes conducted their attacks, 140 Iranian fighter jets bombarded various targets inside Iraq. This showcased the efforts made in the first couple of years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution for the reconstruction and maintenance of the army. As you might know, following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, almost all army commanders of the former Shah regime either fled the country or were retired. Many of them had committed treason and were tried and executed. We brought in a new generation of the army.
Today, Sepah has evolved into one of the most powerful political, ideological, military, and economic players in the country. It has been entrusted with a diverse set of indoctrination apparatus, training programs, and system welfare provisions intended to broaden support for the state. Annually, the government makes a show of military force with parades on Iran Army Day, often demonstrating new defense technologies. Army veterans, active servicemen, and reservists take part in the parades, which are ceremoniously held before the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini. after masterminding a counteroffensive which led to the retaking of the port of Khorramshahr in May 1982, a turning point in the Iraq-Iran war which went on from 1980 to 88, Artesh or the army helped to recover all areas lost to Iraq for the rest of the war. The credit here basically goes to the Air Force. Since the end of the mentioned war, the assigned role of the Artesh has not changed much. It has been led to remain apolitical and confine itself to its mission within the military doctrine of the Islamic Republic. There must be a difference between the Artesh of today and the Artesh pre-revolution, however.
After the coup of 1953, Americans extended their control on Iran, including the country's army. They organized the army according to their policies and strategies. American military advisors, whose number had reached 40,000, a few months before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, had total control of the Iranian army.
Today, commanders at large are post-1979 trained officers who in military colleges received indoctrination in Islamic beliefs and allegiance to the principle of velayat-e-faqih, that's the governance of the jurisprudence. Mr. Obeisi contradicts the generalization. He was trained before the revolution but rose in the ranks after.
My trainer was American. He'd admit that his Iranian counterparts are better than him. He acknowledged that and actually believed it too. When I'd use the term our F-5s, he'd protest, telling me that it wasn't ours, we merely paid for them. The F-5s were called easy maintenance aircraft. When the Americans were leaving, I remember the trainer telling me that we couldn't make such an easy maintenance aircraft operational. He predicted that they'd return in a couple of months. That was what he said verbatim.
The Artesh has four services, the ground forces, the navy, the air force, and the air defense force. Though it has its own command and control and joint staff, coordination between Iran's military forces, consisting of the IRGC, Ministry of Defense, and Police Command, too, is assigned to the general staff of the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran. These general staff headquarters were set up in 1988, and its commanders are appointed directly by the leader, as decreed by the constitution. The overall doctrine of the armed forces, the Artesh and IRGC, is heavily influenced by lessons of the Iraq-Iran war and shifting perceptions of threats against this country. What it's based on is deterring a technologically superior adversary, like the United States. In the context of this doctrine, the ground forces of the Artesh, with some 350,000 men, 220,000 of them being conscripts, are to form the first line of defense against invading forces. In contrast, the IRGC's army, with a strength of some 150,000, together with the omnipresent Basij resistance force, is to establish the second line of defense and act as a stay-behind force in case of foreign aggression. When asked about how Artesh today compared to itself in its pre-revolution form, Commander Obeisi preferred to make a much more amusingly unexpected comparison. He compared its functioning to the US, the manufacturer of its fighter planes.
The Phoenix missile is an advanced air-to-air missile. We didn't have enough of it to use during the war. Our engineers and technicians managed to install surface-to-air Hawk missiles on F-14s. This was another first in the world. No one had tried doing that before. It was a very difficult endeavor to turn a surface-to-air missile into an air-to-air rocket.
The IRGC's army units have been divided into 32 parts, two for Tehran province and one for every other province, to effectively maintain domestic security of the country in peacetime. Mr. Khoshchesh is a senior political analyst and familiar face on Press TV. He joined us on Skype this time.
Considering that Iran is located in a region which is not secure and probably one of the very few countries that you may experience established security in this country, it shows pretty well how it's been successful, how much it's been successful. especially considering that there have been enemies for this country like Israel, the United States, and Daesh or the ISIS that have declared time and again that they mean to undermine security of Iran. And the security that we enjoy today in the country is very much indebted to the IRGC and its security apparatus that have been very much successful.
The 18,000-man Navy of the Atish is charged with the responsibility of forming the first line of defense in the Sea of Oman and beyond, basically our southern waters. It is capable of operating in the northwest quarter of the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, and even in the Atlantic Ocean. Meanwhile, the IRGC's Navy has steadily improved its capabilities to support unconventional warfare and defend Iran's offshore facilities, coastlines, and islands in the Persian Gulf.
In several cases, when they were assisting some vessels that were smuggling fuel in the past several years, there have been stand-ups between the two sides. And the Americans have been trying to help these fuel smugglers. The IRGC Navy has been successful in exercising law and pushing back the Americans to protect interests of the country and to arrest these vessels, seize these vessels, and bring them to law in Iran. Also, there have been several scenes of confrontations when the U.S. Intended to violate the Iranian territorial waters, considering that the U.S. has probably the most powerful naval force in the world. They were expected to, make some kind of scenery and to embrace success probably, but they've been defeated in all such scenes and confrontations in the past few decades, at least in the last 10, 20 years, ever since the Iranian IRGC naval forces, the speedboats, started, very tough missions in the waterway.
The Air Force of the Artesh, with 37,000 personnel, is charged with the responsibility of defending Iranian airspace. It relies largely on inherited U.S.-supplied aircraft that have been refurbished with the most advanced modern equipment by Iranian engineers. Another surprising point of comparison brings out an Iranian superiority to countries it has later on bought jets from.
There are many aircraft manufacturers in the world. Many countries are making aircraft, but not so many make flight simulators. We started off by making repairs and upgrades to the fighters and then built simulators. I remember that before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, they had imported a simulator for an easy maintenance F-5, but it wasn't even unboxed. That was where things were kicked off. After the revolution, my colleagues went through the difficult unboxing and initiation process for the device. Running a simulator is harder than operating a plane. I followed the matter and conducted flights on it.
The Air Defense Force was established in February 2008 for sharper focus on Iran's deterrent doctrine. With 15,000 personnel, the force operates Air Force radars, anti-aircraft guns, and a variety of Russian, Chinese, British, and U.S. surface-to-air missile systems acquired before and after the 1979 revolution. Iran has also deployed its own domestically manufactured missile systems.
We began manufacturing arms from the moment the war started. Take mortars, for example, which are simple weapons. We were under sanctions, so people at the IRGC tried to build the most basic form of mortars out of water pipes. Those who were tasked with building such weapons later managed to produce long-range precision-guided missiles. That was the result of depending on the internal capacities and abilities of the Iranian youth that creates such internally driven changes.
The IRGC seems to be in possession of Iran's medium-range ballistic missiles, including Sejil-2, which makes up the strategic arm of Iran's air power and its primary deterrent. There's plenty more to come, but only after a quick diversion into global media. Here's what other media outlets said. The Middle East Eye quotes Iran's Quds Force leader Ghani, who replaced the martyred Soleimani. He vowed to continue backing militias across the region. The head of Iran's Quds Force, an elite branch of the country's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, vowed to continue leading militias across the Middle East amid stalled hopes for a nuclear deal with the West. Speaking to supporters and senior commanders of the Corps, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani said all Islamic militias would undoubtedly enjoy Iran's backing and took aim at the U.S. and Israel. The U.S. and Zionists should know that this is our definite path, he said. The Islamic Revolution of Iran knows how to guide young, motivated Muslims to defend themselves. Our hands are not tied, and we will respond robustly wherever in the world our interests come under aggression, Ghani said. Tasnim News reads, Army chief warns of Iran's intense response to threats. Commander of the Iranian Army, Major General Abdurrahim Mousavi, reminded enemies that their strategic depth is within reach of Iran, warning that any threat to the Islamic Republic will be met with great force. In a message released on the occasion of National Army Day, Major General Mousavi warned enemies that any action against Iran will cost them dearly. The enemy should bear in mind that its strategic depth is within reach of Iran's military equipment and clout, the commander added. He said the Iranian army has gained considerable experience of real battle under all geographical conditions, stressing that it will respond to any threat with the highest degree of power. In 2019, the U.S. State Department designated the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, as a terrorist organization, an unprecedented action against the military of a sovereign state. In response, Iran has sanctioned United States former President Donald Trump and nine other senior officials of his administration. The individuals were blacklisted for their role and participation in terrorist and anti-human rights acts against the Islamic Republic of Iran and Iranian nationals.
The main reason why the IRGC is under sanction goes back to the impact it has had on strengthening Iran's military and deterrence power. If it wasn't for the army and the IRGC, the U.S. would seek a regime change in Iran. They have admitted to it several times.
Now, one of the remaining final issues in the Iran nuclear negotiations in Vienna to lift sanctions and perhaps revive the Iran nuclear deal, JCPOA, has been the Iranian demand that the IRGC be taken off the U.S. list of foreign terrorist organizations. Last January, Iran's judiciary announced it had requested an Interpol red notice for former President Trump and 47 other U.S. officials who had played a part in the assassination of General Soleimani. Iran has not been able to import large arms consignments due to the multitude of imposed sanctions. Instead, this country has made efforts to produce or assemble its own weapons at home. The government popularized the idea of moving towards self-sufficiency in arms production. Unable to import, Iran has chosen an affordable and shortcut approach to develop a deterrent capability by investing and focusing on its missile industry through assembly, modification, and reverse engineering of imported weapons. Well, once imported weapons. In other words, replacing conventional forces with less clout before a powerful enemy with asymmetric forces, more powerful due to their use of cunning and asymmetric methods. That said, and at least in comparison to its immediate neighbors, Iran's armed forces remain a major conventional power in the Persian Gulf and West Asia region.
Following the assassination of General Soleimani, we conducted a retaliatory operation and struck the Ain al-Assad airbase in Iraq, housing U.S. troops with a missile attack. The missile strike left the Americans helpless. Firstly, they couldn't intercept it, and secondly, it was so accurate that General McKenzie, former CENTCOM commander, said on many occasions that they can't do anything in the face of Iranian missiles.
Iran's military doctrine and strategy is primarily defensive, and so Tehran does not seek military confrontation. Accordingly, the Islamic Republic primarily employs its unconventional capabilities and allies to maintain its overall regional interest. After World War II till the end of the Pahlavi era, advisors from France, England, Austria, and later on from Italy and Sweden made it to Iran for modernization of economic, military, and social systems. The American board's presence in Iran was more conspicuous since Iran's dependence and supporting the Shah had been their main objective. Therefore, with the victory of the revolution in 1979, all foreign advisors to the army left the country and abandoned all their projects. As a result, the Iranian nation was left with very extensive and expensive military equipment, not knowing how to utilize or maintain it without the support of the departed foreign advisors.
It's a difficult task. There are guidelines and books on it. We didn't do such overhauls. They had recently brought in the aircraft and were expected to do it by themselves. That was the case with all the aircraft. Passenger and cargo planes like the 747 were taken to Pakistan to undergo overhauls. But we got to a point where we'd overhaul all types of airplanes in the Mehrabad airport under my watch as its head. We'd disassemble and reassemble them. I believe we've overhauled a dozen types of airplanes, including the 747.
Faced with this situation, the late Imam Khomeini stressed the need for self-sufficiency and localizing military equipment production and maintenance. He did once state that not only now, but also as long as Iranians stand by the revolution, the hegemonic powers will not sell any advanced arms to Iran or offer any help. Today, after more than four decades, this order by the Imam has borne fruit and Iran has towed a very successful path, and it is currently enjoying self-sufficiency and self-reliance in the defense and military equipment industry. At the moment, the country is keeping up with the world's latest technologies in the design and manufacture of destroyers, radars, cannons, missiles, and anti-cruise ships. Furthermore, Iran is ready to supply neighboring and friendly states with its state-of-the-art scientific and military technologies. For example, Iran could also sell its highly capable unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs. According to the Iranian press, Russia has already expressed its intention to buy Iranian drones, although it is likely that the Kremlin would try to acquire a license to produce them locally.
It forced the country to develop its homegrown arms program. Ever since then, Iran has developed even a new doctrine, which is very much based on its missile power. The advancement that Iran made in its missile industries encouraged the country to make similar advancements in other areas of arms production, manufacturing, and development, including drone technology. Iran is one of the top five in area of drone and missile industries and power in the world. The same is true about other weapon systems, defense shields, as well as many other arms, light arms, and heavy machine guns.
The Iranian defense industry could also offer services such as maintenance and modernization packages. Iranian engineers have demonstrated impressive skills in keeping aging platforms operational. According to experts, they are also the driving force behind the technological achievements of some knowledge-based companies in Iran. That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now. ربنا
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh and welcome to the program Bridge coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are looking at As-Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zain al-Abidin Salamullahi alayhi and we are still at supplication number 8 where the Imam alayhi salam talks about a few things that he wants from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and he seeks refuge in him from. Amongst the things that we mentioned, we got up to the point where he says وَضُعْفَ الصَّبْرِ and the fertility and the weakness of patience. We are in the month of Ramadan and tonight is the night of Qadr, the night of power, the night of predestination, the night of destination, refer to it as you wish. It's a very holy night. It's a night, as we call the night of power, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala ordains and dictates what happens to me and you for the rest of the year. So it's a night that me and you need to take extremely seriously and we need to pay attention to because our life for the year to come, if we manage to live that long, it is decided on this night. Allah decides what's happened to us. So we fasted about 20 days so far, and along this fasting, we were told by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to stop ourselves from committing sins and from avoiding certain things which were permissible to us. In order for us to achieve these commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and perform them to the best of our ability, is that we need our arsenal and weapons to be able to withhold, to be able to withstand the pressures that we will face. So it's a kind of a war that we need an armor to be able to apply the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Amongst the things that we need in this month beside piety and taqwa, we need sabr. We need patience, which Al-Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam asks Allah for. So he said, do not give me less of it. I want more of it. Now, before we continue, let us take a short break and then we continue.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and we are still looking at As-Sahifa Sajjadiyya, supplication number 8, the night of power, Laylatul Qadr, and the month of Ramadan. And with all this, we need sabr and patience. Now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He asked me to do certain things and prevented me from doing certain actions, obviously, He has taken into consideration that I will need sabr, I will need patience in order to be able to do that. So patience, especially when it comes to hunger, when it comes to thirst, when it comes to desires that I used to indulge in, and I stop myself, that's when sabr comes into play. So I tell myself that I cannot do these things for a number of reasons. One, I need to obey the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is a question that sometimes we ask ourselves, why do we have to fast? Why do I have to stop eating? Why do I have to stop eating? Not only do I ask that question myself, but I might face that question from other people, especially non-Muslims. So my duty, first and foremost, is to give the most basic answer, which is, I am submitting to the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's basically it in a nutshell. I'm trying to obey the command of Allah And this is what he wants, and I'm doing it. I'm submitting. I'm not going to argue why. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is giving me patience in order for me to perform this task. So this is the first thing. Second thing I'm doing for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to seek His pleasure and to seek His mercy and to seek His favor. Because not only I have to submit, but I myself use this time, use fasting and obeying the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as a way to seek nearness to Him. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He says in the Quran in many times, He says, whenever you're facing difficulty, whenever you have to prevent yourself and do jihad with yourself, you have to struggle and do self-struggle, and you have to go through all these problems in life, then I have given you patience, I have given you sabr, which you need in order for you to be able to overcome these difficulties. So when it is hot, and I'm thirsty, and I'm hungry, the day is long, then I have to say to myself, patience. Sabran sabra. You have to wait for the time to come for you to break the fast. So sabr is extremely required in the month of Ramadan. Let us take a short break, and then we continue right after.
Listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Fasting itself, it is the best, if not the only school that will teach a person the adequates and the benefits of patience. If I need to apply patience, sometimes in my daily life, problems come unannounced, they come without a warning, they come without notification, and boom, I'm in a problem. And sometimes my patience is not ready. So a lot of the times people fail that test because their sabr is caught out of guard. With the month of Ramadan, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He says, I'm going to give you few commands that you need to uphold and apply, and you have to exercise sabr. So this is the time and the school where I and you exercise our patience, our sabr up front, where throughout the day I'm constantly applying it. So whenever I go outside and I see people eating, for example, and I feel like eating too, I get hungry, I smell the beautiful, delicious food, I tell myself, I can't, I'm fasting. So my sabr is active. When I see people drinking, my patience is active. When I sometimes, even in the house, for example, when a person with his spouse and he gets aroused, because we are not meant to indulge in any activities in this kind of arena, I also tell myself I have to be patient. So throughout the day, for an entire month, I'm learning how to become a patient person. So it's a scam. It's a school, it's a boot camp, if you can say the least, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala teaches us how sabr is applied and how it feels to be a sabr. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, وَاسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ. And also, use sabr, use salah as a mean to come to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even though some scholars, they translate sabr as fasting. We leave it here and we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهن عشق و تولای تو را یا
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.